Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, St. Patrick's Day, March 17, 2014. March Madness goes global. And Russia wins Crimea. In this corner, we have Vladimir Putin playing the democracy game. And in this corner over here, we have Barack Obama and NATO allies playing the sanctions game. And already in round one, Putin has come away with a mandate, kind of, to take over Crimea. Now, we'll get to the nature of this exercise of democracy that took place in the Crimea on Sunday. But we have announcements, as expected, from Washington today, and some coming from Brussels, of sanctions being imposed on people close to Putin. Not Putin himself, not his foreign minister. They want them to be able to come to their knees somewhere for a meeting in the world. Unlikely to happen. And I think that the whole sanctions game will be batted away by Putin. Oh, like a mosquito in the summertime. And as I mentioned in my News and Comment podcast on Friday, this is a defining moment or defining period of time for the American empire. Because if we can't graciously accept that we have lost this round, then we're launching a new Cold War that could be endless, that could cost us in more, even greater spending on the Pentagon than we do already today. And as I mentioned, we need Russia. Putin was the adult with the cool head who kept Obama from getting the U.S. militarily involved in the now three-year-old civil war in Syria. Putin has helped broker the most meaningful talks with Iran in, well, since the Shah was running the place. And those are much more important than the future of Crimea, which was part of the Soviet Union, originally part of Russia. It's where the main naval base for Russia is located. They're not going to give it up. And even the most extreme neocons like John McCain, while they operate in a treasonous manner attacking their commander-in-chief at a time of crisis, even John McCain, we'll get to in a moment, doesn't counsel military action against Russia. So responding to this almost democratic referendum in Crimea, Putin issued a decree saying that on Tuesday he will give a speech to the Russian parliament, when many expect him to endorse annexation of what is for the moment a sovereign and independent state, Crimea. And here's something interesting. I hadn't heard from Mikhail Gorbachev in a long time. But he piped up and told the Interfax News Service that the independence of Crimea should be welcomed and not met with the announcement of sanctions. This is the guy who presided over the breakup of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev went on, if until now Crimea had been joined to Ukraine because of Soviet laws that were taken without asking the people, then now the people have decided to rectify this error. So the White House went through and announced these, went forward with the sanctions that have been threatened, and one of the people they've targeted is Yanukovych, the guy who was thrown out of Kiev just a couple of weeks ago. The one who was corrupt but had been elected by his people. And I don't know if he's headed to the baby doc villa in the south of France or wherever the ousted heads of state go, but it seems gratuitous to include him in the list of those who are being sanctioned. That's also interesting to note. This comment came from Radoslaw Sikorski, the Polish foreign minister. When it comes to Crimea and Ukraine, the U.S. is from Mars and Europe is from Venus. Get used to it, he said. And it turns out that Barack and Vladimir had a little telephone chat Sunday afternoon while people were voting under armed supervision in Crimea. And while Obama said that we will never recognize the independence of Crimea or its alignment with Russia, that he said there remains a clear path for resolving this crisis diplomatically. Not sure quite what that clear path is. Obama dispatched Joe Biden, the motor-mouth vice president, to tour the region. And Obama himself has an already scheduled trip to Europe next week, which is likely to be consumed by the issues of Ukraine and Crimea. Now to the ballot that the voters actually saw, those who turned out to vote in Crimea yesterday. And frankly, I was a little surprised when on Friday I learned about the choices that voters faced in Crimea in this hastily called referendum that occurred yesterday, March 16th. By the way, just a personal note, yesterday would have been the 91st birthday of my dad. Happy birthday, Dad. Anyway, the ballot reads, number one, are you in favor of the reunification of Crimea with Russia as part of the Russian Federation? Or, flavor B, are you in favor of restoring the 1992 Constitution and the status of Crimea as a part of Ukraine? Now, neither one of those is actually saying, no, we don't want to make any change. You had a choice of change A or change B. We're told that over 90%, I think it's 93 to 95% of people chose flavor A. So I want to be clear here that I'm not an apologist for Putin, but I believe I'm a realist. I don't believe that this was truly a democratic process and that the people of Crimea have spoken. This occurred under duress in a real hurry. But as I said at the outset, Putin, the hardline autocrat, is at least going through the motions of playing the democracy game. And a little bit later, we'll talk about what's going on in Egypt, where the U.S. continues to back the military dictators who breached democracy by taking power last July 3rd. And that's just one example. And so Putin is playing on the hypocrisy of the United States, on the double standard that is evident to any objective observer. And then when Obama resorts to threats that are largely empty and that may actually hurt the United States in the long run more than Russia, because one of the crucial factors here is that Russia is threatening to take its trade out of the U.S. dollar as the official international currency. They might move to the euro, they might try to use the ruble. But in any case, if they lead that kind of defection, that could undermine the U.S. economy in many ways. For example, we now skate on a lot of currency exchange fees. Because if we buy oil from Saudi Arabia in dollars, we don't have to change that money into euros at the effective exchange rate of the day of that trade. If we do have to take the dollar and convert it to a second currency before we buy hard goods on the world market, we will pay a significant price. And that's just one example of the potential for unintended consequences of this current hard line against Russia. And so John McCain took to the editorial page of Saturday's New York Times, and the headline almost made me cough up my Raisin Bran. Obama made America look weak, is McCain's charge. And this is such an empty piece of posturing. If McCain had been president at this time, how would he have displayed the toughness that he says is missing from President Obama? And as you know, I don't agree with Obama on many of his foreign policy positions. I didn't support the NATO destabilization and overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya. I supported the original position on Syria that Obama took. I supported the previous position that Obama took about Egypt, supporting the election of Mohamed Morsi. And so when McCain says that this is Obama's fault, what is most troubling, he writes, about Putin's aggression in Crimea is that it reflects a growing disregard for America's credibility in the world. That has emboldened other aggressive actors, from Chinese nationalists to Al-Qaeda terrorists and Iranian theocrats. And he says that our withdrawals from Iraq and the threatened withdrawal from Afghanistan, which is long overdue, were, quote, driven more by a desire to withdraw than to succeed. And this is such bullshit. McCain knows there was no route to success in Iraq. There is no route to success in Afghanistan. Nobody knows that better than the Russians. They were bogged down there at great cost. It's one of the things that led to the breakup of the Soviet Union. Back in the 1980s is when these seeds were sown. Zbigniew Brzezinski and Jimmy Carter helped support the opposition in Afghanistan, who made it even worse for the Russians. And so this is so gratuitous and out of line. So first McCain slams Obama, and then he says, well, it doesn't mean military action against Russia. Well, what does it mean? You just talk tough? Go out and, what, torture some kittens? I just don't get it. And McCain has a soundbite. You've probably heard it. And he used it in this op-ed piece. He said, his Russia is not a great power on par with America. It is a gas station run by a corrupt autocratic regime. Have you heard that line? I'll bet you have. Now, some of that is accurate. Russia is a resource-rich country, which is cashing in on its oil and gas deposits. And it's not that big of an economy. It ranks roughly comparable to Italy in terms of its gross domestic product. And that's where it's important to put these things in perspective. And in some ways, we elevate Russia to the level of superpower when it doesn't really deserve it by confronting it in this manner, which I think is misguided, and we will pay a price for it long term. My thanks to the subscribers who support my podcast, and in particular, I want to thank Annawell Rinaldi in Corvallis, Oregon. She just renewed for another year. And in a note, she says that Roy Zimmerman, our friend and minstrel, made a recent appearance in Corvallis. She went out to see him, got to talk to him, and mentioned that she had first heard him right here on the PBC podcast. Thank you, Annawell. And also special thanks to Del Leonard, a longtime listener and fervent supporter in Maine. And he dropped an extra $50 to help us with our audio upgrade fund. Del, I really appreciate that. I'd like you to join them. You can become a subscriber. Just go to peterbcollins.com. Follow the links under my picture on the homepage. You can choose $1 for a 24-hour pass, $5 a month, cancel anytime. If your budget permits, you can go to $10 or $20 a month. Many people do, and I really appreciate that. The best deal is our $50 annual subscription, and for new annual subscribers in the U.S., we will bonus you with the rockin' CD by John Dist called Red Flag, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. And if you haven't done it yet, You don't have to be a subscriber to take advantage of our free offer for a one-month trial at audible.com. If you sign up, they'll give you your first audiobook download free, and you can cancel within 30 days. You won't have to pay them a penny. In any event, if you sign up, they will reward me with $15 for referring you to audible.com. Well, as we reported last week, the signals were pretty clear that the prosecution, the highest-ranking military official accused of sexual-related crimes, has fallen apart. And it is difficult from here to see how much problems with the victim, the complaining witness, undermine the potential for a prosecution. And Judge James Pohl, who presided over this, has also managed some of the kangaroo court cases at Guantanamo. So I can't say that I have exceptional confidence in the judge. But Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair today entered a series of guilty pleas and has escaped being charged with actual sexual assault. The accusation was that at least twice he forced his former mistress into performing oral sex on him and threatened to kill her and her family. And as we've mentioned, the 34-year-old captain who engaged in a 3-year affair with the general apparently has some credibility problems. But as I mentioned, my bias is toward the victim, because if she has, forgive the expression, exposed herself, we don't know her name, but people in the military know who she is, and she has put her life on the line to accuse this general. And I believe she deserved her day in court, even if it caused her testimony to be challenged on cross-examination and even potentially unravel. But this is another case where the chain of command is maneuvering, and in some ways it appears the chain of command actually tainted this whole process in a way that led the judge to order a new round of plea bargaining. And bottom line is, we need, at minimum, the Senate proposal by Senator Gillibrand of New York that requires independent prosecution of these kinds of crimes in the military. And so General Sinclair cops a plea, but sex assault continues to run rampant in the American military, and it's really shameful. Hard to find words that accurately describe the hostile workplace that we submit members of the military to, and that includes many males who are subjected to rape and other sexual assault by people who claim they're heterosexual. And forgive my language, but it's really, really fucked up. And the Obama administration is doing very little to address it. There's been some lip service. But I would also single out Bob Gates, the former defense secretary, the Republican that Obama held over. I read his crappy memoir, cover to cover, looking for any reference to the sexual assault crime crisis in the military that he presided over. And he didn't even bother to mention it. We have a new wave of McCarthyism in the United States Senate, and it's coming in part from Democratic members of the Senate. We recently expressed outrage at the treatment of Debo Adegbole. I hope I'm pronouncing that name right. But he was the nominee of the president to run the Civil Rights Department at the Justice Department, Civil Rights Division, it's called. And because he had worked for the ACLU and had a very distant connection to an appeal that was supported by the ACLU of Pennsylvania into the murder conviction of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the Senate, led by an alleged Democrat from Pennsylvania, Bob Casey, rejected the nomination of Adegbile. And now the president's pick for Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, is in danger of either withdrawing his nomination or having a vote that would turn it down. Why? Because the NRA has declared that he is a gun rights radical. Now think about this for a minute. The NRA is taking the position that it can mow down any dissenter who doesn't pledge 100% loyalty to their interpretation of the Second Amendment, which means more guns will keep Americans safe. And this Dr. Murthy is a former emergency room physician who has witnessed the trauma and death that gun violence can cause. And because he supports a ban on so-called semi-automatic weapons, because he wants to make limits on ammunition purchases, and because he wants to remove the restrictions that keep the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from funding anti-gun advocacy research, he is considered unqualified by the NRA. Now, are we not allowed to have different viewpoints among people appointed to government posts? I mean, the Surgeon General is an honorific position. Sure, the Surgeon General goes around and tries to talk about better ways to keep Americans healthy. And he or she will occasionally testify in support of or against a bill pending before Congress. But the Surgeon General has no real authority. There's nothing there. He can't write laws or impose policies or limit ammunition purchases. And so this shows the stranglehold that the NRA has, and its weak Democrats like Begich from Alaska, who's up for re-election this year, pandering to the gun lobby over a frickin' Surgeon General. It's pathetic. It really is. Kudos to Rick Ramish. He is the new executive director of the Department of Corrections in the state of Colorado. And he got the job after a prisoner had killed his predecessor. Do you remember this? About a year ago, the head of the Department of Corrections in Colorado was gunned down at his home by a former prisoner who had spent time, perhaps too much time, in solitary confinement. Well, Rick Ramish hasn't forgotten that. And in January, he quietly ordered his underlings to lock him up overnight in a solitary cell, in a hole, as it's called in prison terms. And when he came out, he wrote an op-ed that was published in the New York Times, and he has since made significant changes, reducing the number of people subjected to solitary confinement, expanding the amount of time per day that these people are allowed out of their cells, even if it's in a solitary exercise space. And so he is making important and thoughtful changes. And I'm really glad to see this, and I also want to commend State Senator Lonnie Hancock here in California, who has introduced legislation to dramatically change the use of solitary confinement, the so-called SHU security housing units in California prisons. And I've read a summary of the bill. I'd like to see it go a little bit farther, but it's an important first step, and I hope that the debate will enlighten people about this barbaric treatment and that we pay a price for it. We kid ourselves that you can lock people up, throw away the key, and there'll be no consequences. But most people eventually are released from prison. And I also understand the management problems that prisons have with gangs, with hardcore criminals who have friends on the outside and continue to run criminal enterprises while they're locked up. I'm not naive about what prisoners are capable of. All I can say is when you visit barbaric and inhumane treatment on them, they respond like caged animals because they've been treated like caged animals. It's very simple. And people who watch too many movies and have this black and white idea that you can punish criminality out of criminals by treating them in cruel and inhumane ways, well, it's just wrong. And that's why I'm talking about it. As I mentioned a little earlier, the U.S.-backed military dictatorship in Egypt now has achieved an interesting statistic. In just 8 months, they have locked up 16,000 people who have expressed some sort of opposition to the coup, to the suppression of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the continuing imprisonment of the elected president, who's always tagged as an Islamist, Mohamed Morsi. Now, it's pretty clear Morsi wasn't a perfect president. But the U.S., once again, has said that it's democratic for the generals to respond to protest in the streets and oust an elected government. And you hear John Kerry and Barack Obama say that Egypt's on a path back to democracy because the field marshal who just promoted himself from general, his name is al-Sisi, or if you want to be crappy to him, you can call him al-Sisi, he's going to run for election and be the next new Mubarak. And we pretend that that's some exercise in democracy? Well, the blowback is hitting. On Thursday, masked gunmen opened fire on an army bus in Cairo, killing a soldier, wounding three, in a rare attack on this very powerful military dictatorship. And I believe that it's a major, major blunder for us to support a government that thinks it can suppress the Muslim Brotherhood. You don't have to like them. They are a force and a factor in Egyptian culture and politics. And if we really believe in democracy, we would not be supporting this hardline autocratic military dictatorship that's locking them up at the rate of 2,000 a month. And finally today, watch out for Dutch Ruppersberger. Before I tell you why, I want to tell you a little story shared with me by Russell Tice, one of the NSA whistleblowers who has been very generous in revealing information about the place where he used to work. And Russ Tice laughs when you mention Dutch Ruppersberger, who, like Russ, is a big bear of a man. And he said, when Dutch comes to meetings over at the NSA headquarters at Fort Meade, they always make a huge turkey sandwich for him. Why? Well, if you know about turkey, it contains L-tryptophan or one of those tryptophans. I don't know which trip it is. But it makes some people real sleepy. So they feed Dutch a big turkey sandwich, and then he snoozes through the meetings where they tell him the things they want him to know because he's one of the oversight members of the House Intelligence Committee. In addition, Ruppersberger represents the Maryland district where Fort Meade is located. So he is truly the congressman from the NSA. Now, here's why I mentioned the history of Dutch. He is now proposing legislation that would require individual court orders for the NSA to check your phone records, the metadata, that they now collect on millions of innocent people in the U.S. and abroad. But as the Guardian newspaper account reports, his idea has attracted suspicion. Not only has Ruppersberger been a staunch advocate for the NSA and a fervent critic of Ed Snowden, but his proposal would compete with the civil libertarian alternative, the USA Freedom Act, that has 163 co-sponsors and was written by Republican Jim Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin. It's the bipartisan bill, so here comes the Democratic bill to compete with it. Not all the language has been written yet. And when we see it, we'll be able to decide whether this is a Trojan horse or perhaps a Stuxnet virus. And as I close today, I will note that I have avoided most of the excessive coverage on television about the missing Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. Like everyone else, I'd love to see this mystery resolved. But let's just take a look at this. It's been 10 days. And we're told that the NSA and the other spy agencies of the United States government have checked everything they've got. All those intercepted phone calls overseas that don't require any court order, the metadata, the intrusive monitoring of the internet, including Facebook and other social media. We've thrown everything we have at it. And we're told that we've come up with nothing. Now, if billions spent violating the privacy rights of Americans and many others around the world can't crack whatever plot may have caused this Malaysian airliner to disappear, isn't this a glaring example of the myths, the bogus stories we've been sold? That we can trade our privacy and our constitutional rights for these tools that will allow law enforcement and our military to prevent the next attack? It's flat-out bullshit. And so I'd like to call on Thomas Dolby to update this particular song that I'll use as our closer today. And change submarines to airplane. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening today.